Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show, including how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake and Reframe. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the April 10th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, a board member and agent liaison for Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss a show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. So I'm going to go ahead and bring on our guest co-host today. By day, E.J. Wenstrom is a public relations expert. By early morning, she's speculative fiction author of the Chronicles of the Third Realm War series. She's a regular contributor to DIY MFA and Book Riot and co-hosts the Fantasy Girl podcast. So please welcome E.J. Wenstrom to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Thanks so much for coming on. I feel like I had to rush to get over here and I was worried about the storm. And so I'm just like kind of trying to take a breath now.
Settle. Yeah. Here we are.
All right. So if you haven't voted in the viewer poll yet today, I'm going to post a link in the chat right now for those of you who are watching live, and you can go and vote in it. And the question is, do you listen to any writing or publishing podcasts? And that question is in honor of the fact that I launched Queries, Qualms, and Quirks this week, my new publishing podcast that asks published authors to share their successful query letters and their journey from first spark to day of publication. So hopefully you listen to that one if you do listen to podcasts.
I think it's such a great concept for this podcast. I'm excited to hear it because hearing how authors go about creating their queries and then where it takes them, there's always twists and turns, but you always learn something by hearing other author stories, I think. So
I'll thank you. Yeah, it's funny because I recorded about 7 podcasts already because I wanted to kind of have a queue ready. And I was trying to figure out like what to start with. And I was, how do I say this? Like I had some that were definitely like outliers, like people who either got their agent through like some other non-traditional means or whatever. And I was like, I really want to start with kind of like a normal publishing story. But then as I recorded all the podcasts, I was like, there's not really a normal publishing story.
No, and it makes it so exciting, but also so infuriating. And so it's kind of like, all we can do is learn from other people. So this should be really good.
Yeah. Hello, Tamara. Glad you can make it. Tamara's in Australia, so it's morning time for her. Hey, Jen. Welcome. Pubbers are what the regular viewers of my show call themselves, which is really cool. All right. So we're going to jump in and get into the news because we have a wonderful special guest and I want to get to interviewing her soon. After the release of the commemorative edition of Amanda Gorman's The Hill We Climb, which is the poem she read at the inauguration of Joe Biden, she is now one of the best-selling living poets in the country, which is just fascinating. It is also the first book of poetry ever to take the number one spot on USA Today's bestseller list ever.
Wow. Good for her. What, like 22?
23, yeah.
23. Ugh.
Yeah.
Crazy. Good for her. So talented.
Yeah, which is, I mean, people always, you know, it's the joke, like, in the literature community that poetry doesn't sell, right? Like, nobody makes money off poetry. And I know that it's true, but I didn't realize, like, really how true it was, you know?
Not once.
All you got to do is, you know, become an inaugural poet, I guess.
That's it. That's how you do it. We've got the formula now, so everyone else can do it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in other very different publishing celebrity news, did you hear the news that Mike Pence got his book deal?
Mm-hmm.
So Simon & Schuster has signed him for 2 books. I don't know what he's going to do with the second book, but okay. disappointing, but probably inevitable. And they're also the publisher for Hunter Biden's memoir. So I guess at least there's some balance, but you still hate to see publishers lending platform to people who have supported such abhorrent people and policies.
Mm-hmm. And the deal is reported around $3 to $4 million from what I saw.
That sounds about right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Print Run podcast, speaking of podcasts, publishing podcasts, Print Run podcasts, they talk a lot about how we like to think that publishing is like this like force for, you know, liberal policies. And it's really not. It's a business, right? And so like however they're going to make money, they're going to make money. But, and it's funny because you had brought this news item and then I found another news item and I'll post both links, by the way. So for anyone who hasn't watched before, all the news items that we talk about, there are going to be links posted in the comments, I mean, in the description after. So if you want to read more about any of the different items, you can. That was talking about Andrew Cuomo's new book deal, which he got a $4 million book deal, leadership in the pandemic, something related to that, right? But his previous memoir that was not that long ago, he got a large advance for it, not $1 million advance, but close, and then sold so few copies that the math comes out to basically he was paid $200 per book. Like, he definitely did not earn out his advance, not even close. And now he gets a $4 million book deal. And it's like, who's doing the math on this?
Yeah. Yeah. If this is a business, what's going on? It's almost enough to make me want to pursue a career in politics just for the publishing advance and then just circle back around.
That's what my dad told me to do when I started writing books. He's like, you know, political books make all the money. Oh, gosh.
Some things never change.
All right. So we got some more pandemic news for you. The 2021 Bologna, said that right, Children's Book Fair will once again be virtual only this June. The organizers were hoping that they would be able to return to in-person events, but ongoing COVID concerns like variants and that kind of thing have forced them to cancel any in-person activities again this year. I've heard there was like a bookseller convention. I don't remember where, like Upper Midwest Bookseller Convention or whatever, that did in person this year, but I haven't really heard of any going in person yet.
Yeah, I haven't heard of any. Yeah. I can't believe anyone's doing in person yet.
Yeah. It was a smaller one, so I guess they thought it was fine. But I also know there's a podcaster convention coming up in like November, and even then I'm like, I don't know.
I'm feeling optimistic about some events in October and also August, but then this time last year I was feeling optimistic about the summer, so I'm not really trusting those feelings yet.
Yeah,
but we'll see. June's probably calling it close. I mean,
yeah,
I feel like we might get to June and at least have a lot of the country vaccinated, but for a global event, that's really tough. Oh.
I have signed up for one in February. That's as far out as I have dared to hope.
It's very wise.
Jay said, I cannot wait for the next in-person writing or book conference. Me too, Jay. Me too. I would definitely miss them.
It's going to be so good to see old writing friends and just out in the world again.
Yeah. You and I actually met at a writers convention. The FWA one.
Oh, that's right. That is the one in October that I've got my fingers crossed for, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
We'll see. I know that they're ready to go digital if they need to, though.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Oh, man.
Yep.
Speaking of weird times in publishing, actually.
Exactly. So Publishers Weekly held a webinar this past week to look at where the publishing industry is now in 2021 after this last year that we've had. So it's co-hosted by Westchester Publishing Services and included industry leaders from Princeton University Press, Sourcebooks, and a few others. And they noted that there had been increases in book sales in 2020 and even more so far in 2021. I think, if I remember my numbers right, and I probably shouldn't even try to do this, but I think it was like 7 or 8% growth over 2020. And then so far for the first quarter in 2021, it was 20%+ growth. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of wild, but good to see. And then they were saying for last year, there was especially growth among backlist titles. So that was interesting too. Less opportunity for discoverability for new releases, which is a bummer, but more kind of digging into the backlist. Mm-hmm. But they also noted that the year will bring challenges for discoverability as vaccinations roll out and we go back to some of our former activities like dining out and going to the movies. I'm so excited to get back to those, but yeah, you want to see books continue to grow too. So, you know, I mean, if everything else is opening up, then so are bookshops and book events, hopefully, and you know, they'll be able to reopen to full capacity as well. So we'll see. Time will tell.
Yeah, we saw a lot of kind of statistics coming through showing that what people were reading changed a lot during the pandemic too. So there was like a lot of juvenile fiction was huge with all those parents desperately trying to keep their kids entertained, I guess.
Please do anything readable.
Yeah. All right. Funny. So this next news item needs a content warning for transphobia, so heads up on that. The Women's Prize for Fiction announced author Tori Peters made its long list last week. She is the first transgender woman to be put on the list since the award was founded in 1991 in response to an all-male shortlist for the Booker Prize. As you can imagine, the announcement was not without controversy. But the worst I know of was the Wild Woman Writing Club published an open letter complaining about the announcement, calling Peters a, quote, male author. The letter was signed by about 160 authors that I've never heard of and a handful of dead authors, such as Emily Dickinson and Daphne du Maurier. I don't know how to say her name, actually, now that I tried to say that. But
I would have believed that pronunciation.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a disaster, and also just like ridiculous that you're trying to say Emily Dickinson signed this letter.
Yeah, if you're trying to be taken seriously, like, first of all, don't go for the hate move, but also don't sign dead people that everyone knows are no longer here.
Like, way to just like invalidate your entire event. But yeah, that's a mess and super transphobic, and the author is experiencing a lot of harassment over this. So if you read that kind of fiction, feel free to go and buy her book and support her.
Absolutely. All right. Well, on a very different note, this one actually spoke to me as a marketing and PR geek. Cereal Box, which has had a strong start over the past few years with a subscription print and audio storytelling service across genre fiction, has rebranded itself as Realm. So they continue to share the same episodic content that they were before and are even releasing a limited number of free podcasts. So you don't have to subscribe to check them out and enjoy a few stories. And they're calling the rebrand an expansion with a focus on creating even more original content. So I'm curious to see what happens next here. And I got to say, excited to check out some of these podcasts that they're releasing. I've checked out one or two of their stories already, and they're always a lot of fun.
Yeah, and they write for audio. So it's written much, and it's more like the model of like a TV writer's room where they're like multiple authors working on a story. And I had seen something about this before last week or on Twitter where they were saying basically they now had more confidence in an ad supported model And it's probably because of the growth of podcasts, which are generally ad supported. And so I think that's great because it's great for discoverability because you don't have to pay anything to experience the stories that are available with ad. And podcast listeners are much more tolerant of ads than a lot of other markets. So that's interesting too. Mm-hmm. And then also just a little plug. We had one of the authors for a Bermuda Triangle-based series on Cereal Box on the show a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago. time is weird. Dan Colbolt, because the viewers had specifically asked for someone who wrote for something like Cereal Box. And so I asked Dan to come on and talk about that experience. So if you're interested in hearing more about what it's like to write for something like Cereal Box, go check out that episode.
Yes. I am so curious about this model. I would love to try this kind of collaborative storytelling sometime. Mm-hmm. Sounds really different.
Yeah. And E.C. Myers, who also wrote what's that show called? Orphan Black.
Yeah.
Cereal. Now Realm show. He was on the show too, but he was a guest co-host, so we didn't talk about it. But. All right, last piece of news. I saved good news for last. A whole bunch of awards were announced this past week. PEN America gave out $380,000 in prizes, including to Ross Gay, who received the PEN Gene Stein Book Award for Beholding a Poem. That's two words, Beholding. The Guggenheim announced its fellows for fiction, including Tyra Jones, Paul Yoon, and Laura Vandenberg. And the New York Public Library announced the finalists of its Young Lions Fiction Award, which is awarded to an American writer aged 35 or younger each year. So again, all those links are going to be in the description later. So if you want to check out the full list, feel free to go and check those out. There were a couple other awards too. I guess it's award season. They're just coming out. Yeah. So, yeah. Congratulations to all the winners and finalists. All right. And it is time to bring on our special guest. Gabriela Pereira is an author, speaker, and entrepreneur who wants to challenge the status quo of higher education. As the founder and instigator of DIYMFA.com, her mission is to empower writers, artists, and other creatives to take an entrepreneurial approach to their education and professional growth. Gabriela earned her MFA in writing from the New School and speaks at college campuses and national conferences. She is also the host of DIY MFA Radio, a popular podcast where she interviews best-selling authors and book industry professionals, and author of the book DIY MFA, Write with Focus, Read with Purpose, Build Your Community. So please welcome to the show, Gabriela.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Hi, I'm so glad you could come on. I was super excited that you said yes when I sent you that invite.
This is so much fun. And please don't mind Office Cat. She loves to hang out on my desk whenever I'm recording something. So
I love it. Yeah. No, I never ever apologize for cat or dog appearances on my show. My cat sometimes tries to be on my podcast and I'm like, no. It's audio only. They don't care.
Yeah, she's an older kitty, so she now can't jump up on the desk. So she'll like meow and like pat my knee until I pick her up. So we just keep her on the desk at all times, and nice. Solves all the problems.
Do you have what do they call it? Like the fake keyboard for the cat to lay on so they don't lay on your keyboard.
She doesn't really care about the keyboard. Oh, okay. What she wants is to like purr into the microphone and to be on camera because she's so pretty and she knows it.
Yeah. So Jay demands to know what your cat's name is.
So I do not divulge the names of my loved ones in public. So they all have nicknames. So I call my children Little Man and Ladybug, and the cat is Office Cat, and my husband is Lawyer Hubby. So
Office Cat. Cool.
They all have code names. Yeah. So it sounds like my family.
90% of the time I don't call my dog by his real name anyway. So All right. So for viewers and listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain for them what DIY MFA is and all the things that you do related to it?
So DIY MFA, most people think that what it is like an online writing school or an online writing program, but that's not really what it is. It's actually a school of thought. So the DIY MFA approach is really, my goal is to, I guess, redefine or recreate the way writing education happens. And the fact that it's happening online is sort of just incidental because that's where I was comfortable setting up shop, as it were. But it's really about a very practical approach to writing. So for example, and a lot of this came actually from me going to an MFA program, which I loved, but realizing that there were many things that were broken in the MFA system, and there are many things that are broken in the not MFA system as well. And so sort of seeing the things that are broken and trying to put together a curriculum and an approach to writing that helps to fill in those gaps. And I draw a lot of inspiration from fields that are not writing related or even literature related. So a big influencer on DIY MFA curriculum actually is Suzuki Method, which is a method for teaching kids to learn musical instruments. I grew up as a child playing Suzuki violin. I still play to this day. My two kids, Little Man plays the piano, Ladybug plays the violin. So it's a whole all in the family thing. My siblings play, my mom plays, it's a whole thing. But that approach of training, it's very sort of practice focused approach and practical. So you learn by doing things, but you also learn by breaking down the bigger techniques into smaller micro techniques and mastering them one at a time. And so that's the approach that we take at DIY MFA in everything from teaching folks how to write to teaching platform, which EJ helped me once upon a time start putting together the curriculum for our platform and marketing program. So it's all about the practical elements and practicing things and putting them into action right away so that you can see what's working and then make adjustments accordingly. So that's essentially what DIY MFA is it's basically redefining an approach to teaching writing. It's not workshop based. It's not, you know, sort of the typical writing classes that you might see. It's about creating the sort of practice based approach to writing.
So you touched on this a little bit, but I do really love an origin story. So do you want to unpack a little bit more about what it was about your own MFA experience that you came out the other side and decided to share this approach as, you know, some contrast there?
You probably know my origin story already, but most people probably don't. So it all started at graduation. I had done this MFA program, and at the time, I thought that I was going to be a children's book writer. So I had a manuscript for a middle grade novel, pretty much ready to go. I was ready to shop it around to agents and whatnot. I'm sitting at graduation. Now, if you imagine, if you will, we're in the West Village of New York City, because I went to the new school. There's this old church with like these rickety pews, and I'm sitting in this really uncomfortable seat, and like my classmates, we were kind of the slackers and the troublemakers of the program. So we were sitting all the way in the back of the church, and we're like sitting there whispering while some person from, I think, like the marketing media department was giving some appropriately cheesy graduation valedictorian speech. And we're all there like sort of laughing. And then I get this crazy idea, you know, as the sun is streaming through the stained glass, I'm imagining like, you know, the skies are going to part, the literary gods are going to whisper from on high, and they're going to say, "You're a writer." And of course, that didn't happen. So instead, what happened was I had this crazy idea, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, what if I had just done this all myself? Like, this is not Kitty. No. I know you're excited about this story, but no. So anyway, I didn't say that. But I was thinking to myself, like, if I was, you know, what if I did this myself? Like, I had a writing group already. I had been reading a lot of books anyway. I'd been writing a whole bunch of stuff anyway. Like, yes, I loved the program. It was a lot of fun. I met a lot of cool people. But what did I really get that I couldn't have gotten elsewhere? And so I did what any normal human would do in such a situation, or at least a normal writer. I ran home and I wrote a blog post about it. And this was like in 2010 when it was like the heyday of blogging, right? But I had this tiny blog. Like, I kid you not, there were 12 followers. One of them was my mother. Like, I knew that I was going to put this post out into the ether and it was never going to be seen or heard about again. And then the next morning I wake up and there's like a whole flood of emails in my inbox and comments on that post. And I was like, ooh, look, I hit a nerve. So in that moment, I realized like this idea of doing it yourself was resonating with people. But the idea is only the beginning, right? Like, we all have ideas all the time. Writers have ideas for stories all the time. The key isn't getting the idea. The key is actually doing something with the idea. So I'm very like testing and like experiment. Like, in a past life, I was a psychology researcher. So I decided I'm going to do an experiment. So I told myself, self, you're going to blog every single day about this idea, DIY MFA, for an entire month. And, you know, this was the beginning of the summer. So I figured I'd give myself a nice runway. I'd wait until September, you know, back to school, that whole thing. And also because September only had 30 days. And I figured like, you know, at least it was like cutting myself a little bit of slack, right? So I'm like, all right, I'm going to post about this every single day in September and we're going to see what happens. And I figured there was basically two variables I was looking at. I wanted to see if I had enough to say on this subject. And I also wanted to see if my audience of, you know, 12 whole humans who read my blog wanted to hear about this thing. So I figured with each of those variables, there would be one of two outcomes. Either I'd run out of things to say and then I'd be done with it, or I'd have things to say and I'd keep having things to say. And then that's a pretty good sign. Like, I know I can do something with this, right? And in terms of the audience, I figured either I would, you know, bore my 12 followers to tears and they all would leave me alone on the internet forever, even my mother, or I would somehow resonate and like people would hear about this and it would pick up, you know, speed and I would, you know, have some more followers. What ended up happening was the good version of both of those variables. So I went from not knowing if I could write for 30 days about this thing to continuing into October and then continuing to have things to say. And this was in 2010. We're now in 2021 and I haven't run out of stuff to say about it. So clearly like the ability to find material was good. And then in terms of the audience, that's where like the numbers don't lie, right? So I started with 12 followers. By the end of the month, I had 400. So I looked at that and I was like, ooh, okay. Now, I didn't know what to do with those 400 followers. And I made all the mistakes in the book and I collected email addresses using a Google form and once upon a time. And I had to like get rid of all those subscribers because that is not how you collect email addresses. I made all the mistakes so other people wouldn't have to. But anyway, it went from this crazy idea that I had to an experiment and realizing like, okay, this is resonating with people. And then from there, I started to actually break it apart. And I was like, okay, how is this? Like, it's cool to have a blog and to have an idea that you write about on a blog, but that's not a business model. And even then, I kind of knew that like the, you know, blogging heyday of like ad-driven and ad-supported blogs was kind of already on its way out at that point. So I was like, okay, where is this going to go? At first, I thought it was a book. So I thought I'd build a platform and then I'd sell the book and then I'd be a gajillionaire and it would all be over. And then I realized like, well, no, that's not how publishing works. So I started thinking more about what other things I could build that would serve my readers as well or better than a book. And eventually the book came along. So like it exists now, it's out there, but it's not really a big piece of what DIY MFA is about. It's almost more like a glorified business card. Like, you know, people find the book and they read it and then they come and they join the Word Nerd crew. Word Nerds is what my peeps call themselves. So now the folks watching this, you guys are now pubbers and Word Nerds. So yay, you're like part of the Cool Kids Club twice. So anyway, that is the answer. That is the origin story and it's long and involved. So sorry about that.
No, that's good. I remember, I think pretty early on, kind of being aware of what you were doing and thinking it was really cool. So I actually stole this question from EJ. So, by the way, she came up with this, but I wanted to ask it because my friend does something kind of similar to your concept, just for herself. She calls it writing apprenticeship. And I picked up a couple things from her, and I love hearing her talk about it because it motivates me to kind of increase my own self-education. If you want to find more information about it, by the way, for anyone listening, it's Amy Christine Parker. So if you Google Amy Christine Parker, Writer's Apprenticeship, you'll find it. But the question is, what should authors know to DIY their own MFA for a quality writing self-education?
I love that question. Before I answer it, I want to sort of expand on something that you said, because, you know, one of the things that people often, like when I share the idea behind DIY MFA, people are like, why didn't anyone else think of that? Well, the truth is a lot of people have thought of that. Most writers learn to write by reading a lot of books and writing a lot of stuff and talking to other writers. Like, that's basically what DIY MFA is about, right? Like, read, write, community. But the key, so like that idea isn't the thing that's unique, I think, and your friend probably has her own unique spin for how she takes the craft and how she approaches the reading and the apprenticeship piece. And so that's the thing that really differentiates each writer's approach. And like I said, with DIY MFA, a big piece of it is the practical aspect, the practice-based aspect. The other thing that we're sort of known for is the systems. Like, I love mental models. I love taking very vague concepts that are hard to understand, like point of view, and turning them into like Venn diagrams that you can look at and go, oh, I get it now. And so that's what, like, each writer or each program out there, that's sort of the thing that they do is like going to be that's how they are each unique. So how can you DIY your own MFA or your own writing education? Well, it basically boils down to three things. You write a lot, you read a lot, and you're in a community and you're part of that community. Now, the way we at DIY MFA focus on it is that with the writing, we really are focused on the practical side. So I know there are a lot of folks out there who love to plan their writing and plan their work and do like character dossiers and yada yadas. I was one of those writers, and I did so many character dossiers that I never wrote the stinking books. So I learned from that for me and the writers that resonate with the DIY MFA model, it's a lot more about writing the thing that will somehow move the needle in your actual project. So being project focused as opposed to sort of amorphous, like, planning focus. This isn't to say that you have to be a pantser, like right by the seat of your pants. You can plan and plot your book, but still be writing things that could end up in the book while you're planning and plotting your book. So that's one thing that's very focused. And I've actually been doubling down on that a lot. So more recently, a lot of the new curriculum that we're developing is very focused on giving people small, compact assignments, like little homework things, but that actually apply, like could be a scene that is in your novel later, but that helps you practice a different technique. So you're both mastering the craft and also doing, you know, something that could help your book. So it kills two birds with one stone. So writing a lot can mean a whole lot of different things. For some people, it's just journaling, morning pages. They were the bane of my existence. I did the whole I love Julia Cameron. I hate morning pages. I will never do them again. I probably hate mornings, and that's why I hate morning pages. If she had said like middle of the night pages, I would have been okay with that. Yeah. But like morning is just not my jam. Same. So each, like, I think, you know, the write a lot is kind of the general idea. Different teachers and different curricula will have different takes on what write a lot actually means. Same thing with reading a lot. So at DIY MFA, we believe in reading with purpose. So what does that mean? That means reading something that will actually contribute to your, not just your general knowledge of the craft and of writing, but also to your knowledge that you need to publish your book. So reading comps, but also reading books that are contemporary to you and like in the same genre as you, and knowing the landscape of what you're writing so that you then know where your book belongs within that landscape. The piece that I've been really nerding out about lately is the idea of how to study a body of literature. So like there's so many different ways that you can slice and dice a body of literature. And, you know, in an MFA program, the professors will kind of spoon feed you and tell you like what you're supposed to write. You know, like they'll say, write an essay or here's your term paper on X, like this theme and this author's oeuvre. And like, it's not super helpful. Instead, I think as writers, we need to be thinking about what the, you know, what body of literature do we want to understand? And then how are we going to go about understanding it? Do we want to take one author and study that author throughout their career? That's an incredibly valuable study because it gives you an insight about what's going on in that author's life and then what they're producing during those periods of their lives. I mean, I nerded out about Jane Austen's body of work and like what was happening in her life as she was writing each of the books. And the books weren't all published in the order that they were written too, which is really interesting. And then, you know, you could also study a body of literature by looking at, say, a genre and like the history of a genre. Like what is really the very first horror novel? Really, like, can you find the very first? Can you find the very first short story or the very first sci-fi, you know, whatever? And what came after? And where did the different subgenres split off? What were the works that created those splits and that created those, you know, those trajectories where different genres would spin off in different directions? That will then tell you what you're writing, how that fits within the genre landscape. And that can be a really interesting study. And then my favorite is the thematic study, right? So where you're looking at a single theme, but you're looking at it across genres and across time and across authors. And it's the hardest because you really have to get into the theme. So for me, the theme I've been obsessing over for like 15 years is the idea of books as an experience, books as a form of an interactive sort of virtual reality that we experience as humans. And so like, I've been obsessing about this to the point where now I'm writing this whole series of essays on how theme parks mirror books and how books and theme parks are sort of interrelated. It's part of the newsletter. So you may have seen it, EJ, because it's been trickling out little by little, those monstrously long essays. But this has been an obsession of mine for even before the MFA. But like, it's hard to sort of pin that down, right? Like, because it's easy for that to like get bigger and bigger. This whole idea of interactive books is, and like, how are books interactive? And how do they create that interactive experience for the reader? So like, you can look at things like early epistolary novels. Like those are actually interactive stories, right? Because we, the reader, are actually feeling like we're reading someone else's mail. So like, if you think about that, especially in the context of like, you know, the very first epistolary novel, which I think was like this book called, what was it, Priscilla or something? I'd need to look it up, but it was like from the 1700s. Like, think about that for a minute. In the 1700s, you're reading a book where, like, basically you're reading someone's mail. Like, it's already shocking now, as, you know, in the 21st century. But, like, imagine in the 18th century, people were probably scandalized, you know, like, oh my gosh. And it also creates this, like, weird interaction between the reader and the book. So, anyway, reading is really cool. And the thing that I really get excited about is how you study a body of literature in a way that allows you to take what you're doing and put it into a greater context within that body of literature. And then the community part. Well, I could ramble on and on about community.
That's actually EJ's next question.
Yeah. So I could answer that next question and then we'll tie it all up. Yeah.
Yeah. So the question is, what have you learned along the way about building an online community and about the writing community?
So writers are awesome, just in general, like that is truth. I love writers. Like I love hanging out with my word nerds. Like that's my favorite thing. What have I learned about online community? So many things. I think the big piece about online community is remembering that it's a community. I think a lot of people feel like it's online, so somehow it's different. It ain't different. It's still a community. So you have to, yes, you're going to have to bridge certain gaps that you might not have in person. There are also certain things that you get faster and closer online than you do in person, right? Like if you're in person, you can gauge things like people's body language or what they're, you know, how they look or whatever. But online, you get immediacy, right? Like you can talk to someone who's on a whole other continent in like a matter of seconds. So there's a whole other level of connection, and it doesn't make one version more or less than the other. But I do think that people tend to dismiss online like it's somehow less of a community or less important, or you don't have to treat it with the same seriousness or the same sort of importance because, oh, it's just online. Oh, it's just social media. Oh, it's just this. And that's dangerous. That's when people end up doing stupid things and posting things they shouldn't online. And that's where those things, you know, devolve. So yeah, I think treating community, like remembering that online is community and not just online community. The other thing that's really important is giving, like, especially when you're leading a community online. So like if you're an author and you have readers and you want to create a sense of community for your readers, you need to juggle. There's sort of this tension between the one-to-many communication, one-to-one communication, and then many-to-many communication, like sort of everyone together. And it's hard to juggle that. Like as a lot of writers like to default to the one-to-many because it's the easiest, right? Like you send out newsletters once a month or whatever, and it's easy because it's just one thing a month, but then it also doesn't feel as personal for the people who are receiving it. So just being aware that there is this, like there, it's like a triad of community that can happen that you as the leader are creating, and being aware of that and then juggling it. There's also the, you know, personal exhaustion side of things. Like I'm an introvert, so I'm very bubbly when I'm in interviews, and then I will go back to my bedroom and I will crawl under the covers and probably like hide for the next 5 hours. Like that's how I roll. So as an introvert, like you have to take, and most writers tend to be introverts. So we need to also balance that in the juggle. Like you have to build in time for stepping back and giving yourself space. I remember when you and I were at a conference in New York, EJ, and I had a 3-day introvert hangover after that event because it was just exhausting.
We were like round the clock while you were doing your book launch. So everyone, I mean, you were the hot thing. Everyone wanted a piece of you for like 3 days straight.
That'll it was it. Kind of exhausting. It was exhausting. And then I was just like, don't talk to me for a week.
I love that.
Yeah, that's the community piece.
Yeah. I especially love what you're saying about, you know, it's a community like any other. You know, one of my favorite soapboxes about online platforming is don't forget to reply to other people and like have conversations. Don't just spout out your own posts.
And yeah. The thing that gets really trippy, and this is where, like right now, I and DIY MFA are at a crossroads in the sense that I've now had to start separating my personal, like persona, like who I am publicly versus what the brand is. Because the company's now gotten big enough that it, like it's its own thing. And so that's like creating all sorts of shenanigans because I'm like, wait, should I be replying using the DIY MFA handle on Twitter or the Gabriella handle? Like, what do I do? Help me. So, and then my inner introvert just like crashes and burns. And yeah.
All right. So I love podcasts. And so when did you start the DIY MFA radio podcast?
So it was 2014, August okay. of 2014.
So, and yeah. Why did you decide to kind of make that move and add a podcast to all of your other projects?
That is such a good question. Because The thing with the podcast is, from a business standpoint, it does nothing to move the needle for us in terms of like driving the company, right? Like, we don't do ads. It's very intentional. I don't want to do ads, even though I totally respect podcasters who do. It is not the model we want. And so it's one of those things where I'm like, why am I doing this again? Oh, right. The reason why we did it is because I wanted to have an excuse to talk to all these famous authors who would never give me the time of day otherwise. And I've had a chance to talk to some of my like total heroes, and it's been amazing. And then I see them at conferences and I'm not like some random person, and they'll be like, I remember you. And I'm like, oh my gosh, fangirl.
Anyway. That's so, it's so funny because I just released the first episode of my new podcast on Thursday with Cass Morris, and she does a world building podcast. And we actually talked about that, how like our favorite part about doing podcasts and the show is like being able to talk to cool people that I probably wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, it's really fun. And, you know, it's also an opportunity to lend the DIY MFA platform to a lot of writers who maybe like are at the start of their career, or just their books are not like the big blockbusters. Like, yes, I've had a chance to talk to some mega blockbuster writers, but I also get just as excited to talk to like a debut author with a really small press. And like, you know, that to me is really exciting. And my absolute favorite is having people that are my friends, like EJ, on the show. That is like the thing that I love most, is when I get to like use the DIY MFA platform to boost my fellow buddies. Mm-hmm. So yay.
It is always such a blast when you do. You're so generous with it all.
Well, it's like, what's the point of having a platform if you can't share? Like, it's like, you just like sit alone. Like that would suck. Sorry. Am I allowed to say suck on your show? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sure. As long as you don't say certain words in the first 5 minutes, then YouTube doesn't care.
Okay. Oh, we can say whatever we want now. Okay.
Well, we you should have told me that. So. I like swear like a sailor when I'm not on camera. So.
Oh, all right. Well, what do you wish that more writers who are just getting started knew about writing and publishing?
Oh, that's tough, because there's so many things to know. I would actually challenge that question a little bit by saying, don't worry so much about what you don't know, because I think a lot of writers when they're starting out are so panicked by like, I mean, I was that person at a conference who raises her hand at an agent panel and goes, what's a query letter? And, you know, this hush comes across the room and all these people are like glaring at me. And then they're like some people, you know, at the back where I'm sitting who are like, and because, you know, they didn't know it too. But it's, you know, there is that feeling that like everyone else knows about all the things and you don't know. And like everyone else has this, there's like this code or secret language that they're all talking and you don't know it yet. And I would say like, don't freak out. Like really what I think building a career, like at the end of the day, I don't think most writers want to just get published. They want to build a career. And if you're planning to build a career, really what it comes down to is do good work and be nice to people. That's it. It's like any other job. You do good work and you're nice to people. You make friends. You like get to know other people as humans and not as like, how can I, you know, make my way into some awesome book deal or whatever. If you're just nice to people and your friends, then stuff is more likely to happen in a way that works for you. So yeah, I would just not stress about like knowing the things. I would just do good work and be nice.
We've all been at square one at some point. So if you're being a snot to someone else who is there now, then that says more, yeah, about that person, in my opinion. You know, just be nice. Just be nice.
And, you know, I've been to conferences and to events where they have those like pitching rooms or those like agent, like one-on-ones or whatever. And those are all fine. I mean, I did that whole pitch thing. I did the whole agent thing. But the panic that the writers have, like seeing all this like throngs of writers and they're all strategizing, like I'm going to see this agent first and then that one. And like, there's so much angst. Mm-hmm. So like, all I want is to go up to them, just like grab them by the shoulders, be like, relax, breathe. Mm-hmm. As my 6-year-old would say, like, go to your happy place, go to the peace corner. That this is like an actual thing in their first grade classroom. Like, there is a peace corner when you're like having big feelings.
I need a peace corner.
I know. I'm like, why can't we have one of those at home?
Yeah, it's definitely something we experience with pitch wars a lot is when those submissions are open and we get all these panicked emails that are like, oh, I forgot a comma in my query letter, or like, oh, it doesn't look exactly like I wanted it to format wise. It's, you know, it's supposed to look like this and it looks like this. And we're constantly telling them that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And they don't believe us, you know? And it's like, it really, those little things like that do not matter. Because if the book is good, if the query is good, whatever, then it's good. And then like, if you're missing a comma or even if you misspell someone's name, you know, like, it's, the little mistakes aren't really that big of a deal.
I mean, I would never tell people to make little mistakes. Yeah. Purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, we do not strive for that.
Yeah.
But if they happen, like, you just have to let it go.
Don't have a meltdown. I do remember I used the wrong name in a query letter when I was querying, and I thought like it was the end of the world. And then I ended up getting a request anyway. So like,
And at the end of the day, like, if someone's going to be so uptight that they're going to like ding you for that, like, do you really want to be connected?
That is what I say all the time.
You know, and the same thing goes too. Like, it's not just with queries, but like, you know, circling back to the whole podcast thing, like sometimes we'll do cold outreach and we'll, you know, I'd say like 99.9% of the time, authors that we reach out to are very gracious. If they can't be on the show, they're really nice about it. Occasionally, we'll get a jerk. Yeah. And, you know, those moments, I'm just like, well, thank you. You know, made my life so much easier because I don't have to like reach out to you ever again. Yes. Like that just made my job so much easier in the future.
Yes, I'm an event planner and I had, and so I've been an event planner for 7 years. I plan author events only, right? And so when I tell you there's only one person that has ever made me mad, that should give you an idea of like what it takes, right? And it was like, it's someone that if you read science fiction, you probably know this person's name. And I had, I'm just going to say pronouns because this will be hard enough without them. But I had emailed him about possibly doing an event. It was just like the content of the event and if he would be interested in doing it. And his reply was, oh, I don't come to events for less than certain dollar amount. Thanks anyway. And I was going to pay him. I had money to pay him. And I was like, okay, bye. Like, that's so rude.
Yeah.
All right. Emily, we got to hurry up. We're running out of time here.
All right. Bring it home. This is the final question, I think. But I know that this all started with your own MFA journey. So, and you also wrote the DIY MFA book. And I'm very curious, what are you writing these days?
So my current obsession involves theme parks. It also involves taking the DIY MFA models that we use to teach writing and applying them to other fields. So I have this super secret project that I've been working on that my agent knows about, and we are working to, I need to grow my platform a little bit more because it's more mainstream than the writing book. And it also, like, I need to just do a little bit more additional platformy stuff, speaking gigs and things like that. But basically it takes the DIY MFA models and applies them to the world of business. Ooh. And so that has been sort of my secret obsession. I've been like very in small pieces, like kind of testing it at different speaking events for like marketing conferences and other like business events. So that's been sort of my way of beta testing the ideas and seeing like what lands and what doesn't. That's how I beta test everything, by the way. Speaking is like the best beta test of all time because you can see in real time if people are like eyes glazed over or actually engaged with what you're saying and what you're talking about. So that's my current writing project. It involves a lot of like note taking and assembling of information. And right now, the other side of it too, is I'm looking to reading a lot of research on the psychology of storytelling. So like what is actually happening in the brain when we are reading stories, because there's a lot of like pop psychology out there on business books talking about like story sales and yada, yada. And I'm like, bleh. Like, that's just like, where's the science? So I'm actually looking for the science and starting to see like, okay, where it actually is and how does it really apply to what people are doing in business? So.
Cool.
It's exciting stuff.
Yeah.
All right. So this is the final question. What is the most important book you've ever read and why?
So you said I could define it as a book that's like personally important. Yes. So I will have to say that it's The Book of Three by Lloyd Alexander, middle grade, fantasy, high fantasy, sort of like Lord of the Rings light. And the reason that it is the most important book I've ever read is because it is the book that made me a writer. And here's how it happened. I was in first grade. I was kind of an early reader. This book is more like fifth, sixth grade level. And so I walked over to like the fifth grade shelf of the library in our elementary school. And I pulled out this book because it had this really cool cover with this dude who's like in on like riding a horse and he has a skull for a head with antlers. And I was just like, man, this is awesome. So I pulled this book off the shelf and I started reading it. And I read the first page and then I read the first chapter. And then I started to have a complete and total nervous breakdown because I started thinking, well, if I can read this whole book, like I can read this whole book. I could sit here in the library and just read this whole book. And then I could read all the books in this library, which means I will run out of books to read and I will be bored forever. And then I'm going to die. And so the librarian, because I was in first grade. Okay. Like cut me some slack. Like I was six.
That's dark for six.
I know. Right. But and the funniest thing is my daughter is exactly the same way. It's a little terrifying. Anyway, so I had this complete freak out. And so the librarian told my teacher and the teacher's like, I have an idea. So the next day, this is an elementary school or a Montessori school. So they have like stations around the room where you do like your schoolwork. So she brought out a new station, which was a tray. And it had this like pile of blank lined paper, canister of pencils, and then a mini tray where you could put your work at the end. And the idea was that we would write our own books, then we would illustrate them, and then we'd bind them together by stapling the pages and do a cover. And then she would put them in the story corner of our classroom and we could read it to the class. And that was the moment where I realized like there were actual humans who wrote books. Cause I was just thought the books like appeared as if by magic, like, you know, just sprouting out of the library floors. So this was the moment where I realized like I could actually like, not only are there people who do this, but I could be one of those people. And after that, like it was just, yeah, the rest is history.
Nice. Well, Gabriella, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about DIY MFA and everything else. It's been really great having you.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
Yeah. So Emily and EJ and I are just going to go ahead and finish out the show, but we'll say goodbye to Gabriella for now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. That was fun. I feel like we could have kept talking for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's the danger of Gabriella is you can talk to her for hours. Yeah. It's wonderful.
All right, it is time for this week's audiobook of the week, and I have one this week. I did not last time. And it is Once Upon a Quinceañera by Monica Gomez Hira, narrated by Frankie Corzo. And it's about Carmen Aguilar, who's stuck in an unpaid summer internship when she has to perform in a ball gown in the summer in Miami so she can graduate high school. In the same swoop, her company hires her ex, and they're hired to perform at her spoiled cousin's massive quinceañera. Yeah, so it just came out, I think, like last month. And this was a Pitch Wars book, actually, from 2018, I think. And it was the most requested book in the Pitch Wars showcase that year. Wow. Yeah. So I've been very anxious to read this. And it was just, it was super cute. And interesting. There's like some class discussion going on, you know, between her and her cousin, and Yeah, it was good. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Sounds really cute. I'm really enjoying these pink flamingos on the cake.
They get to be like Disney princesses, basically. So they're Disney princesses that perform for children's parties, and it's super cute. All right, let me take that off, and then we'll get to the viewer poll. And so, Ebony, totally adding it to my TBR. Ebony's TBR must be so long because I feel like she says that every time.
Or she's one of those people who read super fast that I'm always really jealous of because I am so slow.
I am a slow reader as well. All right. So the question is, do you listen to any writing or publishing podcasts? And I forgot to pull this up ahead of time. So just give me 1 second and I'll get that on the screen. There it is. Cool. All right, so we had 103 votes and 45% roughly said no, not really. 28% said yes, often, and 27% said occasionally. So I actually expected a little bit more to say yes, but maybe that's just because I love podcasts so much.
I feel like I hear so much about these podcasts and there's so many really good ones out there that I just assume that everyone's listening to them all the time and I'm way behind.
Yeah, that's true too. Like I was thinking the other day, and I think this often is, I read about 100 books a year for the past couple of years. And I feel like I am way behind and like everyone has read way more books than me, even though I see other people's Goodreads challenges. I know it's not true, but yeah, I don't know how many people read so many books.
the book game is hard because no matter what you read, someone's read something different and it sounds really amazing when they talk about it. So there's always FOMO as a constant thing. There's no catching up. Every week I have this angst on Tuesdays of like all the new books that are out that I want to add to my TBR. And I know I'm not going to get to for like 5 years because it's so long.
Oh. Yeah. I get sent audiobooks from publishers, you know, cause we both write for Book Riot. And, I was trying to listen to them like in the order I'd received them. But at some point I was like, I'm listening to a book that came out like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So I've switched my order now. So I tried to read the most recent first and I don't know. There are too many books. Ebony said, I just started listening to podcasts and they're fascinating. Yes. If you need any recommendations, I have both writing and non-writing recommendations. All right, cool. So that is everything. EJ, thank you so much for coming on today and chatting with me. It looks like Gabrielle is hanging out. So if you want to hang out for a minute, I'll talk to you afterwards.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for having me.
Bye. All right. Thank you everyone for tuning in today, whether you're tuning in live or watching the replay or listening to the podcast. Appreciate you however you're consuming the show. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe right there so you don't miss another episode. Or if you're listening to the podcast, please leave a review on your favorite podcast app and tell your friends because that's how they find out about stuff like this. You can also subscribe via the link in the description and find the Patreon via the link in the description. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. You really give me so much joy and energy to do this show. Sometimes it's hard, you know, because there's so much going on and just like having y'all there is a great support to me. The social media and the website for our guests is in the description, so please go check them out. And upcoming, we have the next Pub Talk Live on April 24th. We'll feature Kylie Shakti and Angela Ackerman, the co-creator of the Emotion Thesaurus, among other things. The first Queries, Qualms, and Quirks episode launched on Thursday with Cass Morris. And the next one, this is an exclusive announcement for pubbers, will be featuring Michael Mame, science fiction author. And then, of course, we're continuing our Wednesday write-in. So feel free to come and join us 8 p.m. Eastern for dedicated writing time. And that is everything. Everyone, thank you so much for joining in. Oh, Ebony, I love you too. Thank you. Everyone, stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, and we'll see you next time.